Okay, ladies and gentlemen, let's give a warm Tulare County welcome for our warm-up speaker, Britta.
Hi, I'm Britta. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, everyone, for being here. Oh, I'm nervous. I'm sorry. Okay. Sobriety birthday is 7/22/2014. Yay. So my spirit, strength, and hope. Let's see. February 2013, I got arrested. I ended up my alcoholism going off in college. It just took off. And it led to other things and got me into more trouble. And I luckily graduated with my bachelor's degree in communications. And right after I got my college degree, I decided to be homeless and live in a lime green slug bug for 3 months with my boyfriend and this girl I picked up and panhandled. I was in interview outfits at gas stations with my dad's pretend credit card and panhandled for hours. And that's how I made my living as an alcoholic. I'd rather stay on the streets, live at rest stops, break into, you know, built new homes. I mean, my alcoholism and addiction took me to a level I can't believe the things I did. I can't believe it. In 2009, my parents found me, and they took me to rehab. They said, we need to get you away from this area and get you out of here. And they took me to the Beacon House in Monterey, and I was that chameleon that I will do whatever you want me to do because I know what I want. So I pretended to be the sober, good student and fake it till you make it. And after I did the 28 days, my parents said, no, stay in Monterey. The drugs and alcohol are here in Visalia. You must stay over there. I said, okay. So they paid for me to be in this transitional, a part of the rehab, you know, lots of money for me to stay there. And I worked 19-hour days. I worked, you know, a lot. And I didn't drink or use. And I still went to program. And the minute I saved enough money, I got myself a studio apartment. And the first night I walked home, I got at 40 and went home and got drunk. You know, just like that, the first night away from rehab. And for a year, I pretended I was clean and sober. You know, I went home and got drunk and blacked out, you know, and I was that chameleon. I will be what you want me to be, but I was dying inside. I did not know what to do. I had just, it was that black hole that I didn't want to be this person anymore. And then I got pregnant. And yeah, and I found out I was 5 months pregnant, and I ended up marrying my boyfriend at the time, and I had my son Blake, which you guys all met, most of you, and he, it was a blessing. God has had his hand on him ever since he was conceived, you know, and even after he was born, my life went the same, back to drinking, back to using. I'm a good parent. I'm a stay-home mom. I can do this. And my parents, I'm from Three Rivers, so they said, we have an apartment in Visalia, we have a job for your husband, we have a car, come live here, let us help you get started. And the minute we moved here, it was the alcoholism back, the drugs back. It was just a constant circle, and I was sick of panhandling. I'm better than that. That's what my mind brought me to. And I ended up getting my neighbor's key. He gave it to me, and I ended up, you know, we went into his house and he wasn't there, and we borrowed things without telling him. That was my justification. I didn't borrow this check. I just found it. It was meant for me, right? So, yeah, and that was it. February 14th, I got arrested for 3 felonies, for 2 fraud counts and a home burglary. And I could not believe it. You know, here I am with almost a two-year-old child, and the cops are handcuffing me. And that just brought me to my knees again. Here I am. You know, this whole time God has gotten me out of every single situation, all the times I've been pulled over, all the scary things, and here I am actually getting arrested. And my parents can't get me out of this. And my sister, she came and got my son, and we went to jail that night. And it was awful. Oh my goodness, it was awful. And the next day, my husband at the time, his parents came and bailed him out, and my parents said, you're staying in there. If this is the life you want, you're going to stick to it. And I cried for 7 days in jail. It was the hardest hardest thing I could go through, not having a shower, one shower, not in clean clothes, no food. I was starving. So I got out of jail, and my parents said, so is it the child or your husband? And I picked my son. So I got a divorce, and I blame my husband. You know, he was the one drinking. He was the one using. I would never do that, you guys. I went to rehab. Sorry. And so they played. I'm good at that. I can fool people, and they believed it. And, you know, here I am going through withdrawals, and they just, you know, think I'm just not eating. And the court threw a divorce. The court said, you guys have too much relapse in your life. You need to go see a polysubstance abuse counselor. You have to get help. And I'm like, oh, I got to do this thing again. And so, of course, you know, I find that person, and praise God, he knew me. I guess my parents brought me to him, but I just went to black out. But he guided me to the best sponsor I have today. And during 2013, you know, I did do house arrest. I had to do, you know, instead of 85 days in jail, I did house arrest. I was blessed to have my shower. I was blessed to have laundry, food. The little things you don't think of, I cherish today. Every time I get in a shower, I'm like, best shower ever. And that's 3 years now. But from then to now, you know, I did relapse. I almost had a year, and it was 2 weeks before my year I relapsed. I was not working the steps. I was taking it till you make it. I was being, like, resentful to my sponsor because she's like, you need to read this. Now you need to read this. And I didn't want to read it, but I didn't want to do my 4-step. I didn't want to go through what I have done. I was so ashamed of all the awful things I have done and where I have gotten today. And I said, okay, after I relapsed, I called her and I said, I can't do this anymore. I need help, you know. And that's when that spiritual connection really kicked in. And I put my faith and my control, everything, to God. And he's just given me the life I have today. It's because of him and this program that I've worked the steps, and I did my 4-step and my 5th step, and those skeletons out of the closet. And I don't have to be that chameleon, what you want or what you want. And it's learning about what I want. You know, I'm 30 and I'm like still knowing what I want. And it's so much fun. It is a blast, you know. And I get to go to the courthouse and get my, I got a misdemeanor. They took the 3 felonies and they took them away and gave me a misdemeanor and commercial burglary. Commercial burglary. And so I took that, but it was hard for me to get a job because I had to explain this misdemeanor. But it was so worth it because I didn't have to do jail time. I didn't have to be away from my son. You know, I have a great employer today. I've been at this job. I'm a dispatcher, and I've been at this job for over a year. And, you know, I've gotten 2 raises, and they trust me with their keys, and I'm doing finances. And, you know, I've developed relationships in this program. I have my best friend speaking tonight, you know, and I get to learn how to do friendship. I never did, because it was always that I was the empty shell, and you talk, and I'll agree with you, whatever you want me to say. And today I have a voice. Today I get to find those solutions, and my son, who just turned 5, he gets to watch me, you know, and he is the blessing that I couldn't do this without him. And I'm just so excited to be here and to share. Is that 10 minutes? Okay. So, for me, waking up every morning, everyone's just like, even at work, why are you so happy? I hate it. And it's hard because it's, you know, I could have been a long time sentence, or I could have been dead. All those times, you know, thinking you've OD'd or thinking you've done something, I've done horrific things. And today I get to wake up with this awesome opportunity and be a part of society. I got to buy my own health insurance. And got the letter in the mail, you make too much money. And I just was like, oh my goodness. And so, and just, you know, getting off welfare, you know, pain. And, you know, I'm looking to buy a car. And, you know, my parents are helping me. I've done my amends to my sister and to my dad. And I'm doing those financial amends to them and to my grandma that has passed away. When I was in my addiction, she passed away, and I missed out on a lot. And today, family. I used to hate being with my family. I used to think they were the ones I drank because you were like that. But I learned to do my own dance. You know, I'm changing me, and they're going to always be them. And that's the beauty of it, that I get to, you know, relax and take it easy and not struggle. I read that on page 86-87, on awakening, let us think about the next 24 hours ahead. Before we begin our day, we ask God to divorce us from self-pity, dishonest, and self-seeking motives. I love that part, because all that planning and like, what am I going to do today goes away. Because He has it already taken care of for us. You know, it's cleared for us, and we just have to suit up and show up and shine. I love that. Sorry. So thank you for letting me share.
Let's give a warm welcome to our featured speaker, Blythe.
Surprisingly, I haven't. I have been really excited about this, because I feel like everybody in this room has touched my sobriety in some way from day one to today. And I feel like, you know, Britta shared a great message, and the fact that I get to do this with my best friend. And I hope tonight we just deliver a message of hope, because for me, that's what I wanted, you know, the moment I came in, is I was just tired of feeling so ugly and sick, and I just wanted hope that things could get better. And, you know, that's what brought me into the room, that's what kept me here. And, you know, this is my first speaker meeting. It's only taken me 5 years to get here. My sobriety date is March 6, 2011. So I had 5 years in March. And I don't know, there's something about this year that has just really felt really welcoming to me. You know, I've heard, you know, people say it before, but it's, you know, the middle years between, you know, 2, 3, 4 were kind of hard for me. And I am, you know, they talk about that spiritual, you're stunted, you know, emotionally when you start drinking. And I kind of feel like my poor sponsor got the teenage years of me. The last few years I was going through a little teenager phase, and I think I'm coming out of it. And, you know, I'm starting to have that emotional sobriety that people talk about. And, you know, another thing that has helped, you know, I think I was fearful to get up here and share my story and be so vulnerable. And, you know, because if you guys really knew me, then maybe you wouldn't like me. And when I first came in, my sponsor said, "Do you know that what other people think of you is none of your business?" And I was like, that is crazy, because of course it's my business. It's about me. And she's like, "No, it isn't, because you cannot control it. You know, the only thing that you can control is yourself and, you know, just your relationship with God." And, you know, this relationship that I've developed with my God these last 5 years is amazing. I can get through anything today. You know, in sobriety, I've gone through many weddings, not my own, gone to weddings. Let me just clarify. As a lot of you know, part of my story is, you know, having to be in a wedding at 6 months of sobriety and not having a choice, and looking at that situation differently. But, you know, I've been through 9 wedding cycles. I've been to 2 funerals for people who have died of this disease. Been through my own illnesses. I've been through illnesses of family members, work, no work, you know, relationships and breakups. And, you know, there isn't anything that I've had to drink over. You know, it wasn't anything that I couldn't get through without using a substance. But, let me see, I guess I start from the beginning. I think the first time I ever had a sip of alcohol, I was about 5 or 6, and I remember my dad was having some beers with his friends in the backyard, and they used to like to drink Michelob in those glass bottles, and, you know, they used to let me blow on him, whistle, and one day I guess I asked if I could have a drink, and I thought it was going to be like root beer. I thought it was going to be really sweet tasting, and I took a drink, and I spit it out all over on his pants, and his friends were laughing, and he said, good, you know, I hope that you never, you know, care for the taste of beer ever again. And I remember thinking, so that is something I'm not supposed to drink, so I can't wait to drink it again. And classic alcoholic thinking, right? Let's do exactly what we shouldn't do. And I remember just, you know, throughout the years he'd have beer and I'd take a couple sips. And I grew up as an only child. I do have a half-sister. She lives in Chicago, but fortunately today we have a relationship, but when I was growing up, we didn't. So it was just me in the house with my two parents, and it was a really lonely upbringing. You know, there was some depression in the home and some alcoholism, and it was hard to be, you know, just, you know, by myself. And I think a lot of that led me to want to escape just all the time, you know, through any, you know, turmoil that was going on in the house. I just wanted to leave. So when I finally really began my relationship with alcohol, I was around 14. I had gone to high school. Football games started, you know, the keg parties after the games, and I was hooked. I just, the moment I started drinking, I loved the effect produced by alcohol. I absolutely loved it. I would drink as much as possible because I loved going home and feeling the spins, and like the ceiling fan was spinning around, and like, you know, I almost felt like I was going to throw up, but I'd try not to, and it's like, oh, I love this feeling. I can't wait to do it again. And I remember the first time I drank hard alcohol was probably a couple months into that drinking, and I drank so much I got sick. And then after I was done getting sick, I went back to the table and said, all right, let's start drinking again. And that's what we called the puke and rally. And there was the puke and rally for the rest of my drinking career. So I always lived this dual life. I was like this double agent. You know, I had got really good grades because if I got really good grades, then my parents wouldn't pay attention to me. But then I would be able to go out drinking, and, you know, I was a chameleon, like Berta had talked about, all different types of friends. You know, one weekend we'd be drinking on the country club golf course, the next weekend I'm drinking on the north side. You know, it was not discriminatory to who or what I drank. And I remember, you know, other substances are a big part of my story that I don't talk about a lot. Alcohol has always been my constant, but, you know, in Chapter 3, when they talk about switching from scotch to brandy, I did that with other substances. I pretty much would, anything that was available, I was game for. And I think, you know, thinking back, one of the first times I remember it was New Year's in high school, and you know, we were all drinking, and some of my friend's older brothers had gotten some pills, and they were going to do pills, and I was like irate that I wasn't invited to do these other substances. Like, well, didn't they know I wanted to do drugs too? Like, this is like, and I always wanted like more, more, more. So I ended up keeping the grades together, got into a good college, UC Irvine, down in Southern California, in Irvine, which was about 10 minutes from Newport Beach, and it was beautiful. It was absolutely beautiful, and it was my ticket out of Visalia, because I grew up here in Visalia. So I was leaving this town, and I was never coming back. And first thing I got there, I lived in the dorms, and I met all the people in the dorms that drank just like I did. And I also decided to join a sorority, because those people really drank like I did. And, you know, being a freshman girl in college, I suffered with, you know, emotional esteem issues, and I ended up developing an eating disorder. And, you know, a solution to the eating disorder was I'm just going to take these diet pills called Zenadrin. And at that time, it had the ephedra in it, which this was the early 2000s, so ephedra was not illegal. It didn't get illegal a few years after that. So I find these diet pills, which is pretty much legal speed. And, you know, I decide that these things are great, and they're really great to drink on, too, because I can party all night long, and I can study all the next day, and I can drink cappuccinos and, like, just keep going until I crash. And so that carries on a little bit, and then some of my friends and roommates say, you know, let's stop with the legal stuff and let's, you know, try some of this other stuff. And I'm like, I'm game. So we did. And that's pretty much got me through my college. I don't think I would have graduated if I hadn't. But I had a friend named Jenny, and Jenny, she was my partner in crime. And all of a sudden, we're maybe juniors in college, and she's like, I have to go to rehab. I was like, why do you need to go to rehab? We got a good thing going on. This is fun. Like, we're having fun. And she said, my parents don't think I'm having fun, and I'm living at home, so I need to go to rehab. So she'd go to rehab, and she'd call me, and I'd go break her out of rehab, and she'd stay the night, and we'd party, and then she'd go back. And then, that was my first introduction to AA, and I didn't know anything about it. All I knew was, you know, she didn't like it, but then, you know, then one day she calls and she says, you know, I can't be friends with you anymore. And I was like, okay, well, why? What's the problem? And she's like, well, the problem is I'm going to stay sober, and I can't be around you because you're not sober. And at that time, I was like, well, sucks to be you. Like, my life is still manageable. I think I'm still got it going on, but, you know, if it's not working for you, then good luck in AA, and you go have fun. So we parted ways, and, you know, that was just how I was with relationships, is if it wasn't convenient to me and it didn't serve a purpose, I didn't really care whether it lasted or didn't last. So me and Jenny have our falling out, and then I'm a junior in college, and I'm going into my senior year, and I have to do a study abroad program. It was part of my major, but I got to go to Spain, and I got to study in Spain for a month, and then a few of my friends were going to backpack for another 6 weeks. So I go to Spain with my good friends, because I always have good friends and bad friends. The good friends were the ones that were good influences on me. So those are the ones I went and studied with for 30 days. However, I got kicked out of, I'm a Spanish student dropout, because my books got stolen, my passport, everything. That we were on the beach, and, you know, someone came and stole everything, and I'm calling my mom, and, I mean, my mom is such a sweet lady. A lot of you have met her, and she went through a lot with bailing me out and just being there emotionally for me, and I call her, you know, I'm covered, you know, 9 hours ahead. I'd be like, I don't have any money. I don't have a passport. She's freaking out. She, you know, sends me stuff, and I never told her that I dropped out of school there, because I thought it would have devastated her. That was one of the amends I had to make. But so I ended up just partying for 30 days, because I had an apartment that had already been paid for. So my friends would go to school during the day, and I'd sleep during the day, and then they'd get off, we'd go drink. And, you know, it really escalated a lot there. By that time, I was 21, which didn't really matter. But we decided, you know, my bad friends decided to come, you know, they came a few days, like, after my good friends, and we decided we were going to go to Ibiza Island, the party island in Spain, you know, that was ecstasy capital of the world, and we go, and we have a good time, and, you know, I don't know why you'd want to buy pills for people with backpacks and you don't even know what's in them. But I end up getting, like, walking pneumonia. I'm so sick. I get into the airport. I call my mom again. She's begging me to get a flight home. And I'm like, no, I'm still managing. This is, you know, this is fine. I'm having a great time. So, you know, that whole trip is just me doing the same thing over and over again. And I think I like looking at those situations because I just see the disappointment on my family's face again, you know, of like, here it's clearly an issue. You know, you're losing things, you're not graduating, you're just wrecking your body, and you don't even want to do anything about it, and it's really hard for them to watch. And I come home from Spain, and then I decide I'm going to get a boyfriend, and this is going to fix everything. Poor guy. So, get a boyfriend, and he doesn't know that I'm up, you know, he knows that I'm alcoholic, he doesn't know that I also use other substances, and that's hidden from him, and I graduate from college, end up getting a job with this new up-and-coming company in real estate down in Orange County for homeowners associations, and it was an all-women's company, and they were young, and, you know, it was at the time when, like, the mortgage brokers were just making tons of money. So we were all young, out of college, making tons of money, having parties, just blowing through our money, clubs, just everything just escalates. And I remember it was his birthday, and I had a work event. And I remember saying, I'm just going to stay for a couple drinks. I'm going to stay for a couple drinks. And, you know, kept calling. And the night got later and later. And I never showed up. I showed up, and it was like after 2 in the morning, you know. And alcohol was more important to me than anything. He was getting in the way of my drinking. I didn't care if it was his birthday. I didn't care if it was his funeral. I was not coming back, you know, once I started drinking, my friends knew, don't try to call me. I'm in this, like, warp zone that you can't, like, it's their fault for trying to get a hold of me when I'm drinking. Don't you know that I'm irresponsible and I'm just out of touch? And, obviously that relationship didn't work, and you know, I moved in with a bunch of my girlfriends on the beach in Newport, and it's awesome. There's 5 girls in one house. We're living on the Balboa Peninsula, and there are about 30 bars in like a, you know, 3-mile radius, and again, the drinking just like escalates. It's, you know, another example of my alcoholism was, I say my Thanksgiving story, that I, my mom had gotten me a ticket. By this time I'm like 23 or 24, and she said, you know, there's these flights from Long Beach to Fresno. Why don't you come for Thanksgiving? Can you make it to the airport by 6:30 in the morning, Thanksgiving morning? I'm like, of course I can. I'm not in college anymore. You know, I'm more responsible. And I get all my stuff packed, and my friends call, and they say, hey, we're going to do a pub crawl. And I said, okay, well, I'll participate, but I have to be home by midnight. So my thought was, since I have shorter amount of time to drink, I need to drink as much possible in the short amount of time. I've got 4 hours to take shots, like, of hard alcohol. I have never been so sick in my life. They almost wanted to take me. I probably had alcohol poisoning, and they were asking me throughout the night if I needed to go to the emergency room. And I, you know, I barely wake up. My friends get me in a car, throw me in the airport, Long Beach Airport. You get through in 5 minutes. I'm in my clothes from the night before. I smell like alcohol. I get on the plane. The plane takes off. I totally throw up in the plane, and it's like a 20-seater plane, and everybody hates me. And I get off the, I'm so gross from the night before, and my mom sees me, and she just looks and is like, you did it again, you know, you did it again. I was supposed to help her get Thanksgiving ready, I was supposed to be there for my family, and again, I just am not accountable other to anybody other than myself. So I get through that whole debacle. They're the problem, don't they? No, they shouldn't expect these things from me. So I keep doing that for another couple years, and there's like it escalates, and like getting kicked out of bars and going back with wigs on. You know, and, like, I have a lot of crazy stories. There was a point where my best friend and I at the time, we were X'd out of like 10% of the bars down there, so we had to be really selective. But I mean, I got kicked out of a country western concert. I went to Las Vegas with some friends, and we thought it'd be funny if I almost married this guy named Drunk Dave. And you know, I get to the chapel, and I'm like, no, this is gonna be it's gonna be fun. We're gonna remember this. And they're like, you do not want to get married to Drunk Dave. You don't know his last name, and you know, this is gonna be a really bad situation. And luckily, I always had normie friends that were like, you know, trying to be that sane voice for me. But I, you know, towards the end, I started realizing I drink differently than my normal friends. You know, why do I need to show up at a happy hour and have a couple shots of vodka before we go sit down for appetizers and we all have a bottle of wine together? Why do you guys leave and go to bed and I go home and drink more, either by myself or find other companions? Why is there, you know, I thought that how I did things were normal. And I ended up quitting the first job and going in and telling them that's how they were doing. I was 23 or 24, and I told them why they were running their company wrong, and told them they made too much money and didn't, you know, bought too many Louis Vuitton purses, and they should be giving us more raises. And, you know, this just egomaniac, you know, girl just burned my bridges. Like, I did not leave quietly. It was just like an exit. And I ended up getting picked up at this other job, and this job is going to be better because they have a beer pong table on their balcony. This job is going to be perfect. I go through that job, you know. I think I was there for a couple years, and at the end, I was just coming in, getting sick. It was just this revolving door, and I remember thinking, they need to fire me and put me on unemployment. That would be a blessing. And I got my wish, you know. They called me in, and they said, you know, you're not being very useful to us anymore. We're downsizing, and, you know, here you go. And I went home that day, got on the computer within hours, filed for unemployment, and it actually was during the World Cup. And I was so excited because now I could wake up at 6 in the morning and go to the bars and drink, which I didn't even watch soccer, but I was getting paid to go and drink, and this was awesome. So I can barely pay my rent. I'm like let go of a job, and you know, my family here in Visalia are like, are you done yet? Like, are you demoralized? Like, I end up seeing this therapist because I think therapy is my problem. And the therapist says, I think you have a drinking problem. I'm like, you're a little overreacting because I'm in my 20s and people party and drink a lot. And she said, I don't think that a lot of people party and drink the way that you party and drink. And, you know, she started planting those seeds of, she was pretty much my first unofficial sponsor because she was doing step work on me that I didn't even know. You know, there was, she was all having me look at my part in situations, and she was kind of trying to teach me, you know, that maybe I'm the problem and not everybody else. And she did a lot for me because she laid the groundwork when I finally was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was ready to do some work on myself. And so finally, it's the end of 2010, and I can't find a job. my things are going really bad here in Visalia, and my grandpa was having a heart attack, my parents were getting separated, and my mom was going to lose the house, and there was like all these things. So I was like, okay, I'll come back to Visalia because you guys need me. You need me to be here because I'm going to save everything with no job and don't have my stuff together. But I think it was God really saying, you know, my intention to move here was this was a layover stop until I was going to move to San Francisco. So this was just kind of a rest, and I was going to regroup, and I was going to move to San Francisco. And I get here, and things are just really ugly, and I'm not able to cope with life, and I go see a therapist, and this therapist sees me for a few sessions, and she says, you need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm like, why do people keep saying that I need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous? Don't you know? This is just a hardcore party situation here. And she ended up calling someone in this program, and he was fortunate enough to give her a couple of meetings and that I should go to here in Visalia. And I wasn't ready, so I told her, thank you, but I don't need your services anymore. I'm going to go see another therapist. This therapist number three. Therapist number three says, I think I agree with your other therapist. Alcohol is your issue. So I went to a meeting. I went to the Sunday Serenity Seekers morning meeting, and I sat next to Barbara, Holiday and Barbara, and I was so nervous. They were giving out the chips, and I didn't know what they were, and I asked her afterwards, and she said, well, how long do you have? And I was like, I don't know, I drank like 2 days ago. She's like, you need a chip. So she walked me over and brought me a newcomer chip. But what I also heard in that meeting was, if you think you can do some controlled drinking, go to the nearest bar room. So it's my friend, yeah. So my friend in San Francisco, which I'm already planning to relocate, is having a birthday. And she said, come up, we're going to go stay in the city, and it's going to be, you know, we're going to have fun, just girls trip. And I'm like, okay. Well, I had to bring her a birthday present, so I bring her a bottle of vodka because that's what I like to drink. And we show up, and they have a couple drinks, and I keep drinking. You know, it's the same situation all over again. They have a couple. They want to go to bed. I'm dragging them down to the hotel bar lounge in the pajamas because I'm not ready to stop. And then they go to bed, and I'm drinking all night by myself. And I'm waking up in the morning, and it's just dry heaving. I can't keep alcohol in my system anymore. And I'm looking in the mirror, and like something in me is like, when are you going to stop doing this to yourself? When are you going to stop putting this poison in your body? And I came home, and I think it was just like a moment of clarity for me, driving and pulling over and getting sick and sleeping and then driving some more home to Visalia, and like realizing that this is just not normal. So I came in to, and I decided to take one of the therapist's advice, and I went to a women's meeting. At that time, it was a Saturday morning women's meeting in Cuya Delta, and I walk in and couldn't find it. Security guard had to escort me to the room, so I was late, and I didn't know it was a book study. I didn't know what a 12 and 12 was, and I sit next to a lady who's my sponsor now, and she's, of course, like, showing me the book and, like, where to read and, you know, do I need anything? And I'm like, well, I don't know what this program's about. Will you, you know, can we go to coffee? And, you know, can you just tell me, like, what are the steps? Because I thought the steps were, like, number one, delete all your old friends' phone numbers. Number two, like a how to not drink alcohol, you know, with, you know, pouring everything out. And they were like, no. The steps are, like, you know, about God and, you know, how to make yourself, you know, better, not just, you know, just not just putting the plug in the jug. And I go to coffee, and I said something that really resonated with this woman, and she gave me a hug, and she said, that's why God brought you to me. And I just started crying because no one had ever told me that, you know, they wanted me in their life, that I was there for a reason and that God had brought me. Like, that's a pretty profound thing to say to someone who's new. You know, that God, you know, you're doing in my life what I needed. And so began our career together in Alcoholics Anonymous. Right away, I was introduced to the people in these rooms. And the next meeting I went to was a Monday night meeting. And it's my home group. Today, it's Monday night Christ Lutheran Book Study meeting. I love it. It was really small when I started, and now it's gotten to be a great meeting. And at the time, there was a girl named Lindsay, who was the secretary, and Lindsay and I became really good friends. And she had about 9 months more than me. And then she relapsed, and then, you know, we kind of lost touch. And about a year into my sobriety, Lindsay passed away, and I, you know, had to go to her funeral. And that was really difficult, you know, that this person who had sobriety more than me, all of a sudden I'm sitting in her funeral, you know, mourning this. And that's not the first time that that happened. I had a lot of things early on in sobriety that were really trying for me. You know, 30 days into sobriety, my grandfather got very, very ill. And I feel like God, He's really worked the steps in me. He has worked through me every step of the way. Because I had already gotten to the part that my life was unmanageable. Got it, you know. I was moving on to finding a relationship with a higher power. And my grandpa got sick, and I'm sitting in the hospital, and I just find myself praying to a God that I don't even really believe in. But I was told to just pray, pray, pray until you feel it. And I prayed, and I sat next to his bed it was 2 weeks. You know, my mom was working, so I was fortunate to not be working and be able to be there for my family. And, you know, in between, I would go to meetings, and I'd share what I was going through. And, you know, another member of this program, he writes prayers for people. And I was brand new, and he had put a prayer in his prayer box and said, you know, I hope that your grandfather gets better. And my grandfather did get better, and this man walked over, you know, a month or two later, hands me this prayer and said that he was giving it back to me because the prayer had been answered. And little things like that, when I was new and people were doing stuff for that for me, it meant the world to me that these people in these rooms cared about me, and they didn't even know me, but they knew how important it was for me to be sober. And so I got through that illness, and then I was 6 months sober, and I got a phone call from my old friend that one of my old roommates, Kelly, had passed away, and she was 38 years old, and she died of cirrhosis of the liver. And so at 6 months, I'm sitting in her funeral, and I felt like I heard God be like, you get your butt in that chair, and you listen to what all these people are saying, because this is real. Like, I didn't think that a 38-year-old could die of stroke of the liver. I thought that that would happen when you're in your 70s or 80s, but she did. And I had tried to get a hold of her a couple of months before to tell her I made it into AA, and I was hoping to share the program with her, and now it's too late. I didn't get a chance. She did get my phone call, and her dad had said that she didn't want to talk to me because she was too far. They'd already told her that she was going to pass away. So I walked through that in sobriety, coming into meetings and sharing and crying and having people, you know, tell me how am I going to walk through this. And then I get to 9 months of sobriety, and my friend here from Visalia that I grew up with, she asked me to be in her wedding. I'm bridesmaid in her wedding. Which is amazing because I had to make amends to her for a lot of my drinking, and she still wanted me to be in her wedding. She forgave me, and we're in the limousine, and they're passing a bottle of champagne, and I have my hands on it. Like, I have 9 months of sobriety. I am ready to drink this. I am smelling it. I'm in a confined space. Everybody's drinking. People are asking me why I'm not drinking. The crowd that I'm with, half the people didn't show up to the wedding because they were in rehab. Like, legitimately. Legitimately, like, three people were in rehab in Clovis, and that's why they couldn't make it to the wedding. So I'm with my old drinking friends, and like all these things are getting triggered, and I just start text messaging. I text message my mom, I text message my sponsor, I'm texting some friends. I'm like, I can't do this. I need to get out of this, like, this car right now. And I get out, and I just, you know, I'm those tools that, you know, anytime I went into a situation, I talked about it with my sponsor and other people, and they gave me a game plan. If you feel like drinking, this is what you need to do. You need to reach out, can't get a hold of anybody, serenity prayer, you know, be of maximum service. What can you do for the bride? This is about the bride. This isn't about you. This, how can you help her get through her most important part of the day? You know, no one's going to notice why you're not drinking. This is your alcoholic, you know, behavior, narcissistic thing going on. So I get out of the, we're at the country club, and you all know that there was a member of us that was a big part of the country club, and I see him, and I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm not alone. Okay. It's just, even the thought, the sight of him, and he knows he's such a big part of my sobriety too, because that prevented me from a relapse right there, was just seeing him and being like, I'm not alone. There are people who get through these situations and don't drink. And, you know, I go and sit down at my table, and I didn't know that so many people as AA, you know, get jobs there. You know? And so my server is an AA, and the busser's an AA. And, you know, I'm leaving, and I get to see someone else in AA, and I'm like, yes, I don't have to change my sobriety date. And you know what? I came home, and I'm like, that is the best wedding I've ever been to. I danced. I felt so free. Just, I don't know, I've never felt, you know, just so free in my, like, in my own skin before in my life. It's always been masking. And I get home, and I realize that's the first time I'd ever gone to an event and come home sober and gotten in bed sober. And that was an amazing, you know, first for me. And then, you know, just going through, life's events and sobriety, it's been a crazy journey. You know, getting to the ninth step and making those amends, it was one of the most challenging but rewarding things I've ever done in my life. I had myself at the end of my amends list, and after checking off all the boxes, I get to the end and I feel this freedom. You know, I can look back at these situations today and feel like, I would wake up in the middle of the night just sweating and regretting, like having all these regrets that I'm a terrible person and that no one understands, you know, how horrible I am. And I love coming to this program, and women hear your story and they laugh because they've done it, they've done something worse, or they know someone who has done something worse. So, and I've experienced through sponsoring people that everyone comes in thinking that they're the worst person, and learning that you're among people who have done a lot of crazy stuff, and, you know, there isn't anything that we haven't heard, pretty much. And then working, you know, 10, 11, and 12, the maintenance steps. For me, the maintenance steps are 6 and 7. I need to work on my character defects on a daily basis. And right now, my sponsor and I are going through Drop the Rock, which is an amazing book. And, you know, just life today is just better than I ever thought it would. Like, I'm at so much peace with myself, and I think that this program just has changed my life. And just, you know, the biggest gift that I've gotten are my friendships today. I, you know, they were so disposable to me in the past, and today they just mean the world to me. My friendships, my relationships, it's like, people are my gift today. I enjoy spending time with people. You know, I'd rather spend the time with people than to get gifts or do anything else, but just make memories. You know, for my birthday, Britta and I went to a Carrie Underwood concert, and, you know, we just made memories, and it was a blast. And there's just so much fun in these rooms, and you just have to make sure you get a really good sponsor. And you know what I've learned about sponsorship too is that, you know, not everybody is compatible with everybody, and that's okay. You know, if you're working with somebody that you don't feel comfortable opening up with, then talk to someone else. And, you know, don't be afraid of hurting, you know, your current sponsor's feelings, because mostly we just want you to be sober. You know, we just want you to find that person that's going to help keep you there. And the camaraderie in this program, you know, it's just, I never thought that I would look up to people who are alcoholics. You know, that people, they're my role models today, you know, and they're, you know, just even in little things like that. You know, like at work, I've learned how to be a good employee again. You know, I've gone through a situation recently where I wanted to react like I did in my other job. You know, I wanted to just light that bridge on fire and burn the whole place down. And today I don't have to do that. You know, I can use this program to get through those events. You know, I can still, you know, hold myself, my head up high, and I can be a woman of integrity today and honesty and respect. And at the end of the day, I'm much happier with myself and my behavior than if I had just burned it down. You know, I feel like I respect myself more. And, you know, there's a lot of, I think, what else can I talk about? There's a lot of great things going on in our community right now. You know, there's a young people's group that's getting started, and I feel so privileged to be able to be a part of that. You know, just that's giving back, you know, just sharing my story and my experience. And I don't know, just I'm sure that... I had a great day today. I did. Surprisingly, you know, I don't know why I wasn't nervous. It's because I've had this really close relationship with God lately. And another member, you know, in the program used to come up to me at the Bridge Street meetings, and he would say, "Thy will, not mine, be done." And I would tell him, "You are not speaking English," because I didn't understand what "thy will" meant. Who is thy? What does that mean? "Not mine, be done." Like, until I started working in the program, and today I say it over and over again. Like, His will, God's will be done. Like, I'm not in control of the situation. You know, anytime I started worrying about this, I would just think, I'm not in control. God's going to deliver a message. Hopefully, He's delivering a message of hope that, you know, people who are on the fence about this program actually do want the sobriety thing, because it's actually pretty fun. And I thought that coming, being young and sober was going to be miserable. And I've had so much fun in sobriety, and like going to concerts sober and going on vacation sober and remembering everything. And when I came in, I was devastated that alcohol was my problem. I wanted to have an incurable disease more than alcoholism. Don't take away my alcohol. I was in tears. Everybody knew that I cried throughout my whole steps, so maybe 9 months to a year. You know, every time I worked with my sponsor and I read the book, I could not have believed that somebody came before me and wrote a book explaining exactly how I feel inside. How is that possible that these, you know, two white guys in Ohio in the 40s know what I'm going through in the 2000s? And it's spot on, you know, every time I read it. And what I love about the big book is, you know, the more times you read it, you get a different thing depending on what, where you're at in your sobriety and where you're at in your life. At least I do. And I have learned that my happiness is a direct result of my connection with God. You know, my happiness today just depends on, you know, waking up in the morning and praying and making sure that anytime something goes wrong, I just turn it over right away. You know, I'm not in control. He's in control. And my life is much better when it runs that way. And I'm just so thankful for, you know, everybody who's been here to support me, who came tonight, you know, and I don't and I feel so blessed to have met such a great group of people. So I think that's all I have tonight.